My name is Clancy Imislund, and I'm an alcoholic. Well, at least that thing won't shit all over my yard. It's really a touching, very little gift, folks, when you stop and think. This is my 25th annual visit to West Covina, my ongoing, endless attempts to bring some idea of action out here and get some papier-mâché burrow, for Christ's sake. Well, stay away from that burrow, Jim. I'm glad to be here tonight. As I said, most of you know this tedious story, but I'll tell it. At 25 years ago, I guess their speaker canceled out on, because this meeting was being held on a Christmas Eve in the basement of some little American Legion Hall or something. They couldn't get anybody to talk, and so they called up the 6300 Club, where I lurked at that time, and said, we need a speaker. Well, I didn't have any front teeth, but I was able to disguise it by a power. I tricked the man for you. And I was able to hustle some old puke to give me a ride out here, and I came out here, and I wasn't feeling terribly good. My family lived in Dallas, and my parents lived in Wisconsin, and I didn't have anybody close to me that I could see. I had just sent some presents to Wisconsin, to Texas, to my kids. And so I got up, and they were kind of a scurvy bunch. There must have been about 20 of them. And, you know, what kind of a people would go to a meeting in West Covina on Christmas Eve? And just... There wasn't any coffee break. At the break, the secretary just went around and dusted the exhibits, you know. And Jim led that meeting. Jim has led every one of these meetings, of course. But I was feeling a little, and it's taken up most of my time each year with this tedious little story. So I came out here, and it was a small group, and I was feeling kind of crappy, so I thought, whatever I say here, we'll never get back to the real AA in Los Angeles anyway. So I just talked honestly, which I said, you know, Christmas is a bunch of crap. I said, when I was a little boy, used to be wonderful, used to come to my grandma's house at Christmas, and Christmas Eve. I haven't gotten to the sad part yet. Maybe just having a bridge tender raise the bridge, I don't know. And we used to invite my grandmothers, and it would be snowing, and we'd sit around and wait for my aunt and uncle to come down from Minneapolis on the train, and we'd have to wait for the gifts, and we'd be so excited. We'd eat lefse, and we'd eat Norwegian fatik bond buckles and scroll buckles and all sorts of good things, and then they'd come, we'd open the gifts. I always wanted the Shetland pony, which I didn't get till some years later. I never wanted a papier-mâché burro. I never, ever wanted that. But my dad would take me home on my sled, and I'd be tired, and I'd be a little boy, and he had a little box on my sled, and I'd ride him holding my presents, and I'd go to bed and feel so excited and fun. Now, to me, the smell of cigar smoke always was the emblem of a holiday at my grandmother's house, and it was just wonderful. And as I got older, I wanted that kind of a Christmas, and it never came around, and I wanted it for my children, and it never came around, and it's just tedious. And by the time I came out here to West Covina, Christmas was a hideous time. My first Christmas sober, I was sober about almost 2 months, and I was living in the back seat of an abandoned car in the AA Club parking lot. And I knew if I got thinking about Christmas and what should have been and what might have been, I just couldn't stand it, and I was so sentimental and emotional anyway. I was working in a jewelry store briefly until I found me dusting two longs amongst the watches. My kids almost had some nice presents, that's your order. But they nailed me, and, I mean, they didn't nail me, they didn't do anything, but I had found some little animals, and I sent little notes to them. And I've told this story before, but I found these little animals. They were a dollar each in a thrifty drugstore across the FBA Club. There was a little rhinoceros and a little bear and a little lion and a little something else. And I was making little notes, and a guy at the A Club said he'd pay the postage and put them in a box and send them to him if I'd get them ready. So I wrote cute little things around their neck and sent them down. And this one lion, as I was looking at him up close, he really was just, he wasn't right. He just, I couldn't have, and he looked all right in the shelf, but when he got up close, his seam was about just a quarter of an inch off all the way around, so his eyes were just, and his tail and his legs, and I'll tell you my state of mind, I identified with that lion, and I kept that lion. That lion stayed at the head of my bed for 15 years. Well, one day my dog Smokey ate it in a fit of poop. always, every time I get carried with my own magnificence, I look at that little lion. I look just great on the shelf. It's just up close. You just know. So I came out here and I told them I'd sent these kids these presents. And I thought, as far as I was concerned, Christmas was a bunch of crap and I don't want to hear any more about Christmas. Oh, I started to say my first Christmas. Where am I going to get away from Christmas? It's Christmas Eve now. Everybody's, let's all go over to Helmy's house and sing carols. Let's do this. My family's going, shit. And I didn't know what to do, so I slunk on down Fairfax Avenue to Cantor's Jewish Delicatessen and sat there all night and drank coffee. I didn't hear one Merry Christmas from a lot of people were clearing their throats all night. Hanukkah, Hanukkah, but who knows about that? But I told them that story, and I said, ever since that Christmas was a bunch of crap, as far as I'm concerned, Christmas ends when I get my presents off to Dallas to my kids. As far as I'm concerned, Christmas is a bunch of crap, and I'm glad we're all here tonight because Christmas is goofy. It's a terrible thing. And I sat down and I thought, whatever I've done for these people, I've given them something to talk about next week at the meeting. Well, you should have been here for that crazy son of a bitch. We had him on Christmas Eve. I thought he was going to bite us, but he didn't have any teeth. But Mr. Andrus, who seemed so well and so put together, came stumbling up after me and said, that was a marvelous talk, Clancy. You want to talk for us next Christmas? Are you sure? So I came out the next year and gave much the same talk. Things were a little better. I had a clean shirt. You want to talk for us next Christmas? Sure. So now here's the 25th straight year I've been out here. They still have me on year-to-year option. I'm not invited for next year yet, depending on how rotten I am tonight. But I was thinking about that. I was talking to someone this afternoon. 25 straight years talking at the same meeting on the same weekend, that's almost approaching consistency. And I have never been noted for consistency. I've always been noted as a very inconsistent. One of my bosses quoted someone else, but in describing me once as saying, watching me is like reading Shakespeare by lightning flash. When it's there, it's really sharp, but it ain't going to last long. Christmas to me is, for many years, was always associated with something bad, because Christmas, I am sure most of you are like me, whether we like to talk about it or not, but I found that most people like us are down deep. We are romantics. We are very emotional. When I say romantic, not in the love sense, but in the idealistic sense. We want things to be romantic and well, and want things to be the same and good. Like tonight, it sounds like a dumb thing, but I feel hurt because that's the first year that fireplace has not been on since I've been coming out here. And I like to go over there and toast myself and run down over there, and there's just a bunch of hot numbers already sitting there. I toasted myself on them, fortunately, but... But, you know, anything like Christmas or anything that I can dream about, there's no Christmas 19, whatever year it is. Christmas to me is, I want my grandma to be there. And I want my grandpa to be there. And I want to be waiting for my Uncle Vern and my Aunt Alma to come down on the train. And I want to see the snow going down. I want to be riding on my sled late at night and watching the lights go by and being just full and happy and getting back to my room with the pennants on the wall and all the wonderful things that I wish had been there. But it never is that way. And it's a funny thing. Christmas, they always say, should be a wonderful time for romantics like us, but it's a bad time for... It was. It isn't now because I found ways to deal with it, but for years it was a bad time. Some of the worst experiences of my life have happened in the autumn and at Christmas. I don't know why. I've been in jail, and I've been beat up, and I've beaten up, and I've done terrible things. And there's one thing you can always be sure of, no matter how high your dreams are and your hopes are, on Christmas morning when you get up, by Christmas afternoon, you will know this wasn't it. This was not it. I don't know what I wanted, but I didn't get it. People don't act right, and people, it isn't the same. And I always felt that, among other things, was one of my problems, that I was cursed with exceeding ability to know what would be wonderful, and other people aren't, and they don't care, and they're willing to settle for gray things and second-rate things. They don't seem to have any interest in things, and I want things to have color and emotional color. Again, I've said this so many times when I've talked, but it's certainly true. You know, I sit, as I probably will this year, with my granddaughter on my lap, and we watch different granddaughters as they get bigger, but always new granddaughters come along and watch The Wizard of Oz. And I just, at the end of the show, Dorothy tells the guy, "I'm going back to Kansas. We're going back to, come on, Toto." And I just want to jump up and say, "Don't go!" You know, Kansas is gray. It's worse than gray. It's sepia tone. Just, yeah. Here's for you, Aunt Em. Yeah. I want to be where there's color and, you know, vivid things and wonderful things. And the world is not made up for vivid things. The world is made up. The world is a kind of a gray place. And you can look and you find colorful places, but sooner or later, they get gray. Everything gets gray. And damn it, I want things to be wonderful. You think that's funny, little miss? Now I've lost my place and I'll have to start over. My name is Clancy Emmerslin, and I'm an actor. That's the trouble with these memorized talks. You lose your place for one second. I don't know whether or not you know how this meeting happened to be. 25 years ago, and our best to your apothecary. All I want is a little color out of life. That's what I want. I'm sure most of the people in this room are like that. The longer I've been in AA, the more I've realized. People like us want things to be right. They want them to be colorful. And they want them to be fun. And they want things just to be wonderful. And you'd be willing to do whatever's necessary to bring it about. But I want things to be wonderful. And when they don't stay wonderful, I feel disillusioned, and I feel traduced, and I feel this isn't the place either. And it took me a lot of years in Alcoholics Anonymous after I was sober to come to one of the great realizations. I'm not saying this for the old timers, I'm sure they know it, but for the newcomers, I want to tell you something funny that may save you a great deal of pain. And that is this: nothing is wonderful after you're used to it. Nothing is wonderful after you're used to it. And yet, immature personalities like mine, and I presume like some of you, keep wanting things to stay wonderful, and if they don't stay wonderful, you're not doing it right somehow. Again, that great example. I don't know a better example. Young men. I'm sure it might be the same with young women, but I know about young men. When you have found what you conceive to be her, and you know that you will blossom at her smile, and you sit and eat lunch with her, and you both reach for the salt, and your hands touch. It's just impossible to realize at that moment that in a couple years, no matter how wonderful your relationship was, the morning is going to come when you're going to reach for the salt, and your hands are going to brush, and you're going to say, "Give me the goddamn salt." You know, just... Now, what that tells me is that she has gone bad. And it's that way all the way through life with employers and employees and jobs and homes and neighborhoods and situations. Sooner or later, they stop being wonderful. There's also a corollary to that, oddly enough, and as most of you know, I work in the middle of Skid Row, where people are dying every day. And every time I come to work in the morning, maybe I'm the only one who does this, when I come to work, I have to crawl over the bodies of people dying on the sidewalk. And, in fact, I was just down there. We just stopped on the way out here tonight. We had a little crisis, and I stopped for a moment watching the guys getting their cardboard boxes out on the sidewalk in the long line, pulling their cardboards up so they won't freeze in the night. And I had to stop because the guy that works for me makes my coffee maker and my aide de camp this morning was stabbed almost to death and robbed. And they stabbed him in the back a number of times. He's in intense critical care at Martin Luther King Hospital tonight. And I was the one to stop by and see what was going on. I talked to the nurse. But I see as much horror maybe as most people. Maybe a doctor in a cancer ward might see more, but I don't know how much more. And it's a funny thing. People say to me, "How can you stand it down there? How can you stand it? Every day you're watching people die and people going insane and people fighting and taking knives and cutting each other and just dreadful." But that's the other corollary to that other thing. Nothing is horrible after you're used to it. It's not pleasant, but it's not horrible. You know, you just lose yourself in it's just a frame of reference. Nothing, it isn't horrible to me. It's sad sometimes when I see guys dying, but it's not horrible. It's just one of the conditionings of life. It's almost as though we are conditioned to come back to the middle, which is good for us, except if you are immature emotionally like me, and perhaps like some of you, I might die before I realize there's no place that's going to stay wonderful. There are no people that's going to stay wonderful. And as a result of that, I was always being disillusioned and disenchanted in my life. And I changed jobs, and I changed towns, and I did a lot of things. And I went to psychoanalysis, and I got into metaphysics, and I read books. But the one thing that always helped me over the hump was a few drinks. A few drinks has two great values. It restores some sort of inner imbalance. You can't even put your finger on it, but you can feel it, and we've all have felt it. Just things are out of balance somehow, and you have a few drinks, and you're back in balance. And with any kind of luck, it adds a little color to the world around you. Just a little color. I don't know a better way that ever was described in the movie and TV show Days of Wine and Roses, where this woman had been taught to drink by her husband, and then he eventually went to AA, and she wouldn't go to AA. And she visited him in the final scene in their little apartment. And he said, look, we've got a little girl living in the other room in there, a little daughter. And I can't have you around her drunk all the time, and you love her, and she loves you, and she cries for you every night. Can't you at least try going to AA and doing something about it? And she says, you just don't understand. And she cried. She took him to the window, and they looked down on the street. It was kind of a grubby street, San Francisco. And puddles of filth and so on. She said, look at that filth. And turned over garbage cans, and a guy laying in the street. It's filthy. She said, when I drink, I just see the reflections in the water. I can't stand ugliness. I wish I could. I'd give my life for my daughter. But I can't stand ugliness. And that's what sobriety is. And all of us know that phenomenon. Sobriety is gray. Sobriety is endless. Sobriety is colorless. Sobriety is tedious and like a long gray tunnel. And you can do it for a while, but it becomes apparent to me, and I presume to people like you, that when you're sober a while, it's easy to see. My problem is not really alcohol. My problem is this grayness of my life and the frustration and the anxiety. And the loneliness, not the loneliness that comes when you're alone, the loneliness that comes in the middle of crowds of people like this, when you get more lonely than you ever were when you're alone. And the uncertainty of what I should do. And the committee is in full cry in your head, casting ballots incessantly. And nobody ever green on anything. Just... And you find yourself giving delayed answers as you drive down the freeway to what some son of a bitch said to you, and you suddenly think of the answers. Oh, is that so, you son of a bitch? You know. And you look over the next car, and there's a guy going... I always pretended I had a car radio. But all the frustration and the stomach aches and the feelings of being different. Somewhere there's got to be a place to go. Now, I know that drinking serves no long-term answer, and I know it's unreal. I know it's just a temporary thing. But I'll tell you, when you feel bad and gray and lonely and sad, a few drinks just gets you through tonight. That's all I want. Just get me through tonight. Maybe I'll stumble on something tomorrow. And... unfortunately, people like us are noted for two things. We sometimes drink to bring a little equality, and then sooner or later we drink until it's unequal again. Only now it's a little more dangerous to ourselves. And some of us become bizarre, and some of us become highly introverted, and some run the streets and get in fights, and some lock themselves in their room with a bottle, and on and on. But the one thing happens. I change where I am. And I was taken to my first AA meeting in 1949. I was just a young guy out of the Navy and out of the university after the Second World War. And all AA told me, they were nice people, they meant well, but they were people who somehow could live in a gray world. And they were satisfied just not drinking, which is not my problem. And from then on, the battle continued. And I fought it for years in cities and states. And I was successful sometimes, and I was a failure sometimes. I would start to do better, and it would gray out on me, and I'd go down. One spring, I was nominated to be Junior Chamber of Commerce Young Man of the Year in the suburb of Chicago. By the end of the same year, I was playing piano in a cheap bar in San Francisco, a whorehouse, really, because there was a hotel upstairs, where the girls would come down and work the bar and bring guys up and come back and on. And I ran to a guy I'd run the Navy with, and he said, let's get out of here. You're killing yourself. So we went to Texas and started all over again. I got a job in a newspaper, then I got back into advertising. I was on the faculty of the University of Texas directing a grand opera at night, and working in an advertising agency in the daytime and writing a weekly sports column, and I was had it grayed out on me, and they finally, I had to drink too much to add enough color, and they called me and said, "You can't drink." And I said, "Okay," because I had to say it, because my wife was pregnant again, and our insurance was on that damn university health plan. And so I went on the wagon and went back to AA, as I always did, and I tried different things, and one day it got so gray, and I couldn't stand it. And I just waited until my wife went to church with the children and pushed the car in the garage, drove it in there, and hooked up a hose, and turned the motor and went to sleep. I cannot live like this, and yet I'm not allowed to drink. And I can't find the place. And some neighbor heard the motor running and found me dead in that car and pulled me out and beat on my chest and got my heart started again and breathed up my mouth. And they took me to the psych ward and examined me intensely for a couple of weeks and determined I was a badly split personality, probably hopelessly badly split. And I was committed for an indefinite period after the rest of my life to the Texas State Insane Asylum. Now, when you wind up in the Big Spring State Insane Asylum at Big Spring, Texas, on a lifetime commitment, if you think you were depressed before that, not only is it depressing, it's your basic resume buster. That is really just...
"Yes, but what did you do these 34 years in here?"
"Well, I..." And I escaped once. I thought about that later, years later. I was down in that city last year with my children. I was talking at a convention. I wanted to show them where they'd lived when they were little. It was kind of a touching. They'd never been back there in all these years. Now, some of them are on the faculty of the University of New Mexico, and some are students there. So I picked them up. We went down to Texas, and I showed this little city. Here's where you lived, and here's where you went to your first mass. And here's where you went to school for the first time. And here's where they put Daddy away. And I wanted to rush in there just to find that psychiatrist, hoping against hope he'd still be there, and just grab him by the shirt front. He must be old and feeble by now. "Hey! You examine me, and you put my life on the line and diagnosed me as a schizoid personality, as a split dual personality. That you could have ruined my life with that misdiagnosis. You know, really. Jesus, you know, I didn't find him, but that's what I'd have said to him, you know. Yeah. You had no idea what was wrong with me. If I could have got my personalities down to two, I'd have been all right, for Christ's sake. You know. I'd have made it from there, you know. That meant three-fourths of the committee were on vacation. I sometimes hear people in AA have talked about it, saying you only find group therapy that will really help them. You go ahead and have your coffee. We'll have ours after the meeting, for Christ's sake. But if you ever want, I'll tell you, most of us, I'm sure, group therapy is easy to find. Just get upset and drive your car alone down the freeway. Just, yeah, that's true, y'all. Yeah. All right, sure.
You want some coffee?
No, I'll wait
till they have theirs.
That happened to me just a little while ago. Christ, I didn't. And I finally got out of that nut house because they put in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was there, and I'd been around AA for 7 years, and I knew how to hustle those alcoholics. I just waited for poor Mr. Ross, and I just laid on him. He was the AA counselor. I was in the psychiatric ward. I had just come off electric shock. That's not funny. Maybe funny and one flew over the cuckoo nest. It ain't funny. It ain't funny when they got the thing in your mouth.
"Okay, now you just you bite this. It's gonna be fun."
"Ah!"
"Yes." "Just let us put a little sauce on your head here."
I'll tell you, you take enough of those, you don't worry much for a while. You just
Do you remember my name, Fred?
Hart, Schaffner, and Marx, does that sound right? But I was afraid, and they broke me, and I laid a story on that old fool, and I finally got into AA there. I was just pilot study in the state of Texas as to whether or not psychiatric commitments should be allowed to attend AA meetings, because they were two different programs. But I hit that old man in the hall. I said, "Mr. Ross," I gave him my newcomer look. I said, "Mr. Ross, I've been here on a commitment, on a suicide commitment, and you know, Mr. Ross, the only depressions I ever have, the only time I'm as bad as when I get caught up in that damn booze. And when I'm sober, it's so, I just feel so good, but sometimes it's like an obsession just grabs me, and I have to drink. And I understand you have some sort of a literature or some kind of meetings where we can learn to put the bottle away and return to the God we've lost." And that old man's eyes went... He had never seen a sincere newcomer. All the people he saw, that was under New Texas law in the 1950s, where your family could commit you for 30 days. You had no choice. You had to go there. You'd be locked up and treated for alcoholism. And I just hated it. Well, I got going to their meetings in their Ward 9 there. You know, I'd sit next to a guy and say, "What are you going to do to get out of here, Fred?"
"I'm going to kill that bitch."
So he welcomed the sincere newcomer. And they came and went every 30 days, and I stayed and worked myself up to secretary of the group. And they used to send me out to little towns around there and give little talks. Just wonderful little talks. Never given me any better sense. You know, somebody would take me over to Midland or Odessa or the Big Spring town meeting and say, "Now we have one of our patients from the hospital going to talk to us tonight. Cliency?" "On behalf of my friends at the Big Spring State Hospital, I want to thank each and every one of you for bringing a message of faith and hope to us. It's as though we were lost on a vast desert of alcoholism. When we came across this vast desert, we came upon the tall green hills of sobriety, but they were too steep for our weary legs. But folks such as you pointed out 12 golden stairs that we could climb one after another. And now as we climb those stairs of sobriety, we look forward to going to our homes throughout the West Texas area to carry this message that you brought to us. It sometimes must seem tedious and boring to you to come to our hospital, but you know the love you brought to our hearts. I'm sure you'll continue to do it. May God bless you in your wonderful work." Now, you can laugh. That got me out of the Texas State Nut House, boy. And the funny thing is, I never had another drink. Until I ran out of Thorazine. But you run out of Thorazine, you have a tendency to get edgy. But I had another big job. The biggest job of my life was after that. And the worst fall after that. And after that, I'm on Skid Row. And on and on. And the only thing I ever wanted... Where is it going to be all right and then stay all right? AA is a nice place, but AA isn't for people like me. It's for people like them. People whose problem is drinking, and then once you get off the drinking, being able to accept the other end of the unfortunate AA parley to return to God. I'm sure some of these people just have a wonderful time returning to God, but not me. I am not really an alcoholic because my problems come when I'm sober. And even if I were, returning to God is the last therapy that I could accept. Not because I didn't believe in God, but because I believed in God too much. And I was a lost soul. I was a sinner and a lost soul. And I knew that when I was 10 years old. And I knew it thereafter. And sometimes I'd go to meetings. Sometimes I'd stay sober in towns for a little while. And be with a group of guys who didn't talk about God. But sooner or later, there comes the God grinders on you. They always go up, you know, sidle up with them after me. "Oh, Sonny,
I heard you talk at the meeting, and I just hate to see you fight God. And just all I could do to keep from saying, well, ma'am, you'll never see me fight God again.
Now you can just hear me fight God for a while. That's why it's kind of funny. One day after I'd lost my family and my home and my occupation and my front teeth and my everything I had, my hope and my dreams, and I was thrown out of the midnight mission as a hopeless case and down and out, finished. One morning I walked 71 blocks in the rain out to that stinking AA club where I already had been banned for stealing the coffee money to walk in and think, I got to hustle these bastards one more time. I got to lay a story. I couldn't even get a newcomer look anymore, so I tried to dazzle him with verbal pyrotechnics. Since I had recently lost my teeth, I was still having trouble with my consonants, and he cuts into the flow of... I'm not just a bum, you know. And I had no idea then or thereafter that that would be my last drink, because I could not conceive. I did not want sobriety. I didn't want sobriety. I didn't see... There's nothing sobriety could do for me except make me suicidal eventually. I just... If I had any strength left, I had to find the right place. The place where I would fit in, where it would stay good. Where you could live with people, and they wouldn't turn into crap heads and selfish people and nasty people and backbiting people and hurtful people. And people would be like they were at my grandma's or someplace. Someplace. And now it's been, as you know, something over 26 years since I've had a drink or a pill or marijuana or anything or any therapy other than Alcoholics Anonymous. And much to my surprise, Alcoholics Anonymous is what changed me. And Alcoholics Anonymous, I already knew all about it. What in the hell are they going to change? I could recite them. Sometimes, one time in Dallas, a guy made a 12-step call on me. Somebody called him on me. I didn't call him. And he came over to quote the book to me, and I pointed out where he was misquoting the book. That made him so pleased with me. He closed his goddamn... That's a goddamn smart ass! But, you know, what are you going to do? Well-meaning simpletons. They mean well. They really do. AAs are nice people. But they... Their problem is drinking. My problem is feeling and thinking. I'm sure they, if they had the power, they could like to do something about it. But they don't understand. Because... Now, we joke about this sentence, but I'll bet this one sentence kills more people than all other sentences in the history of alcoholism. But they don't understand my case is different than theirs. And it's funny, we joke about it, but I'll bet you that kills 99% of the 99% of alcoholics who die drunk, which is getting pretty close to all of them. Yes, I know. There's nobody questions. I used to sit in bars and discuss AA. Nobody ever questions the fact that AA works. But it just doesn't work for me. It works for them. That's what everybody agrees on. AA works. Wonderful place. For alcoholics. But not for people with memories and what might have been and needs that cannot be met by a goddamn gray life. And that's the big battle you and I will face the rest of our life, to somehow find answers to that question. Now, I had to overcome those two terrible things. I'm not an alcoholic, and even if I am, I can't return to that God. Intellectually I can, but in my gut I can't. I'm not going to pray to God. The only way I've been able to live is to pray that God doesn't exist. And to run with other imitation intellectuals who feel the same way. And to laugh and scorn religious people. Idiots.
nuts. Seventh-day Adventists selling their goddamn watchtowers. Idiots. Crapheads. Simpletons. Doesn't mean there's any denomination. Whatever's... Now, the first one took me a long time to overcome. I was sober several months before I began to get a glimmer that maybe I might be an alcoholic. That's one of the things that people like me learn after they're sober. That's one of the things you got to remember if you're new. You know, it's kind of an irony we ask of newcomers. All we ask of you is that you be honest and open-minded and willing. Christ, if you were those things, you wouldn't be coming here. You know. I hope to achieve them by next year. Parts of them. We really should say, all we ask of you newcomers is to be dishonest, close-minded, and sullenly unwilling. And you're home. Maybe the only place in the world where being a snot is an eligible requirement. But a great many people, it's amazing how many people, I know a lot of old-timers all over the world, and I've talked to them about this. It's amazing how many old-timers, successful leaders of men, the great gurus, discovered they were alcoholics after they came to AA. They knew they were in deep trouble and they came here playing this game, but my problem isn't alcohol. And if you can survive here and stay around people who are pushing you forward and stay away from the fringers who are telling you you don't have to do those things, all you have to do is not drink, which is death to alcoholics, by the way. That's another thing you might think about. There's always in every group people who say, you don't have to do this, you don't have to do that. That's just crap. And it's part of my mind wants to hear that. But I'll tell you something. When you get sick, they don't get sick for you. When you are drunk, they don't go to jail for you. When you're down on your buns, they don't come over and agonize for you. They're on telling somebody else what they don't have to do. There are some people, apparently, who stay sober in AA, and I've known a few of them, who don't do anything, who live lives of goddamn pain and frustration, but their stock in trade is, I never did that stuff! In every meeting, you hear, not every meeting, but most groups, there's always somebody. Wow! I'm here for sobriety! I don't want to hear that emotion shit! Right in inventory! Ha 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 ha! I remember years ago, I had a newcomer. We went to the Brentwood meeting one time. Must be 20 years ago, 20 more than that. And this guy, I was trying to get him to write his inventory. He said, I'm not sure I need it. And there was a speaker that night. I never wrote an inventory. And I've been sober 17 years. And he went on like that. And we started to leave, you know, after the meeting. We went out, and the kid said to me, he said, well, you've been sober 4 years. You say write an inventory. He's been sober 17 years, and he says, you don't have to write the inventory. And I wish I could have thought of an answer right then. Yeah, well, I'll tell you about that tomorrow. Took me 2 days to think of the answer to people. I know how to be negative. I've been negative all my life. That's my defense mechanism. It does never work, but I stick with it. Maybe next time. But you do these things and you come to understand something strange if you stay here long enough. That it's true, just as you suspected and I suspected. My problem is not really alcohol. So you would think that means I'm not an alcoholic. Just the opposite. If your problem is alcohol, you are not an alcoholic. How does that grab you? That sound heresy and upside down? But that little statement I just gave you sounds like joke. But unless you can come to understand that, it's almost certain you will die drunk. If your problem is alcohol, you are not an alcoholic. How can that be? Exactly true. If your problem is alcohol, that means when you are sober, you are all right. Then you are not an alcoholic. something else has to be present. If you are an alcoholic, your problem is not alcohol. What is it? If it isn't alcohol, what is it? That I'm goofy? Nope. That I'm wrong all the time? Nope. What is it? It's something that sounds like alcohol, and we talk a lot about drinking in these meetings, but it isn't alcohol. It's something called alcoholism. Now you say, what's the difference between alcohol and alcoholism? A little three-letter suffix. What difference does that make? That's just sophistry. That's debater's tricks. Not at all. The difference is basically this. If your problem is alcohol, stopping drinking overcomes your problem. That's all. You have to pat yourself up and say, hey, I'm not drinking that anymore. It's killing me. In the disease of alcoholism, almost unknown, here's how it happens. In the disease of alcoholism, stopping drinking has no effect on you whatsoever except to make your life more painful. And that's funny, but that's why everybody dies from it. Way over 90% of people like you and me will die from it. A large number of people in this room will die from it. Some of us who have been here over the years, in this group, Harvey Rim, there's been several people at that first meeting, and we're here for meetings afterwards, who eventually drank again. And there's people I've known. And the man who taught me that died drunk 24 years ago. My sponsor, the man who stopped to change my life, died drunk. Because he got off the track and got... I'll tell you something, another great truism. Making mistakes will never get you drunk. Making mistakes will never get you drunk. Defending mistakes will get you drunk. We all make mistakes all the time. But when you defend mistakes, you got to prove you're right. You got to set a whole new unreal set of circumstances to always prove you're right. And one day, the conflict is intolerable. That's why they have a tenth step about admitting we were wrong and why we talk about mistakes and errors and things like this. We have to... That's what this... I bet two-thirds of the surrender in AA after the primary surrender. The surrenders are, I was wrong. And the longer you stay sober, the more you know it and the less you want to do it. Because now you got an image. I wouldn't want to disillusion the newcomers and have them think I was wrong. But you got to keep doing it again and again. But the point is, it turns out you and I have a physical difference. And that physical difference is that we have a special reaction to alcohol. It turns out, I learned this long after I was sober, months and years. And what it is not that I stay drunk all the time or I get crazy when I drink. Alcohol does something positive for me that it doesn't do for nearly anybody else in the world. It alters my perception of reality. It adjusts an imbalance and it adds color. And it makes me whole. And it doesn't do that for over 90% of people who drink. That's why they cannot understand why I drink, and I cannot understand why they don't drink. You know, just as baffling. It's just hideous after work to stop with a guy and say, let's have a drink. That son of a bitch was crazy today. Another one. Oh, no more for me. I've got to get home. Betty's got dinner on.
Better go home, Mr. Whipped.
I would never drink with that son of a bitch again ever. If I had to drink out of my shoe, I wouldn't drink with a guy like that. You know. Poor, pathetic little broken animals. Have another one. No, I'm starting to feel it. That's why you drink it, asshole. We've talked about it at this meeting. That's one of the terrible things about... You can tell him... You want a good way to tell him... An alcoholic. When he drinks, he's solid. Because alcohol does something special. When he's sober,
he's growing edginess and irritation. And you can be a doctor of philosophy at MIT, who I knew got drunk and died, and a doctor at Caltech, who I used to sponsor when he was about, when I was about 3 years sober, and he said that that works that way for ordinary minds, but not mine. And he got drunk and choked on a piece of steak in a restaurant and died. They didn't call it death from alcoholism, but it sure as hell was. And on and on. Alcohol's got to do something for you, and if it does that for you, it gradually grays out reality. And by the time it's doing something to you, reality is untenable. So you get to a position where reality is untenable, and now drinking is untenable, and that is called alcoholism. And nearly everybody who's got it knows they don't have it because their case is different. Because the problems are real when I'm sober. And the pressures. And you don't understand that. You stop drinking and you feel fine. I stop drinking and I want to die. And it's interesting to understand. That's what AA is about. If your problem is drinking, you shouldn't even be around here. Because all AA deals with is the grayness of reality. The word alcohol is only mentioned in the seventh word in the first step and is never mentioned again. It just talks about what drove us here. From then on, it's perceptions and living in reality. That is alcoholism. That's what AA is about. The very things that make you feel that your case is different makes you belong here. It's really an irony. And it takes a lot of work and a lot of time. Because you got to act yourself better. You cannot think yourself better because your perceptions are screwed up all the time. Sometimes they're not and sometimes they are, but they all look the same. We've all had that feeling, getting up in the morning and just seeing everybody's gone to hell since last night. How did you all get in contact with one another, you goofs? Yeah. Spot him on the freeway. Here he comes now, Betty. Cut the son of a bitch off. Yeah. Okay, so let's just say for the sake of argument, you come to AA. Now, you're here. You're willing to go along with these old pukes and give it a shot. All right. You just listen at those meetings, what those people are saying, some of them. It's a shiver down your spine. They say it a lot in the South. I say sometimes here. My name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic, and through the grace of God, I have not had a drink since 1970 or whatever it might be. Through the grace of God and the blessing of God. The grace of God is what keeps people sober, a lot of people here say. But if it's the grace of God, I can't stay sober. I knew that. If God took any group and said, you can stay sober, you can't, you can, you can, you can't, I know that I'll never be included in the you can's. Because I am a sinner. I have broken all the commandments. All of the commandments. I've said this a few times. I want to say one thing in my own defense. There's one part of one commandment I have not yet broken. And I can't even give you a promise on that. But up till tonight, I have not yet coveted my neighbor's manservant. But as you get older, things look differently. Now, I had to surround myself by people who preached action. There seems to be two camps of people in AA. People who say, action is the magic word. And the people who say, God's grace is the magic word. Or the magic approach. I got to go with the action. Because I am damned if I go with the God's grace. Now, you may run across that paradox. People start grinding you about God. God's grace. when deep in your heart you know you don't have God's grace. Anything you got, you better fight for, because you're going to get it from God. And so I stayed in the action course. Most people here have never heard me talk much about God. I talk about the steps. It includes God, higher power. It was a long, labyrinthian way that I even came to come to believe in a higher power. My higher power was not God. My higher power was my sponsor. I had to invest my faith in him and hope he wouldn't let me down. He didn't. He died drunk, but he never let me down, because he said, if you don't do these things, you'll get drunk. And he'd stop doing them, and he got drunk. Boy, they talk about a graphic lesson. Thanks a lot, Bob. You know, what are you going to teach me next? How to decompose? You know. Well, I wasn't as nice then as I am now. And over a period of time, I've been very active in AA. In fact, when I needed a sponsor again one day, I was feeling so good, I thought there was anybody in AA up to my standards. Maybe Bill Wilson, but I didn't like his position on niacin. That offends you, just dilate your blood vessels. But so I got a sponsor a little while later. I thought I'd get a sponsor. And so I found a sponsor. He's the man ahead of me who was the most active man I knew in AA. Whatever he was the most active man. And I interviewed him a little bit. I said, how about this God stuff? He said, the God is within you and the God is within me. That's the God with a fire. I said, you're my man, Slim. And he became my sponsor. My sponsor, I talked to him at least once a week for the last 20 years. And last week he died, Now I have to find somebody else ahead of me, highly active. That's a very difficult search. But I stayed in action. I did these things. And I tried to do the things AA said. And I was weak and heavy laden and fallible and made terrible mistakes and continue to do it even today sometimes. Not as much. But I try to do better. And a while back, I don't know when it was. I don't know if somebody asked me the question or asked me about my feeling. They said, we never hear you talk about God. And I said, no, I never do talk much about God, primarily for the reason when I was new, when people talked about God, I turned them off. I never heard what they had to say. They could have been saying the magic sentence of how to live forever comfortably, and I wouldn't have known it, because they're just another God shouter to me. And I had to start thinking about the evolving of my life. I evolved from a sponsor. I came to believe an AA is my higher power after a while. One day, I found myself taking a considered risk. I made a prayer to God because I felt good that day and rather secure. I don't know if a lightning bolt would come and say, oh, there he is now. You know. But no burning bushes spake. Nothing much happened. Just I felt a little better and I slept a little better that night. And I prayed to that God every day, and maybe oftener than that some days, for well over 20 years. And yet, you don't hear me talk much about God. Because how can I have God when I don't deserve God's grace? There's a paradox here. I'm an activist. I'm not a godder. I'm an activist. And yet the funny paradox is, I look over my life, it's almost impossible for me to think back far enough when I didn't believe in God and trust him. On the main part. As a human being, I sometimes lose that faith, and I have to work my way back to it. But how can this be? God's grace. If sobriety is God's grace, why should I take these actions? And if I take these actions, what do I care about God's grace? And it turns out, I don't know when it happened. Sometime a long time ago, I took enough actions in AA to come to somehow deep believe, not in my head so much, but assume that perhaps my concept of God's grace was wrong. That maybe God's grace was not, as I had seen it in my immature guilt and fear, as a selective thing, given to one, not given to another, given to this good person, not given to that sinner and that drunk. That maybe God's grace is as most theologians talk about it. It, as Shakespeare said, it falleth as the gentle rain from heaven on the just and the unjust. It comes on everybody. And God's grace has been available to me, I suppose, since my first breath. Tonight when I stopped at the mission and I saw these guys in their boxes and they're shivering and cold, I wanted to take them inside except our beds are all full. Got no place to put them. Wish them well. I have to believe that God's grace is as significant to them as it is to me. It's as ever present to them. God's grace is on everybody equally. But why is that guy dying on the sidewalk and I'm going to West Covina in a suit and a carload of people feeling good and secure and no clouds in my sky at the moment? Why is that? And I have to believe that that's what resolves the paradox. For people like me, I get sealed within. The God's grace is there, but it serves me no purpose because it can't get through the seal I have built to protect myself. And the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous, little by little, open that up. For people like me, unless I take the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous, all the knowledge of God's grace is extraneous. That's why they have a home in the East. I've been to a couple times where they send clergymen from all over the world. They come in, alcoholic clergymen, crying. But I thought I loved God, but I can't stay sober. And AA's teach them how to take actions so they can live comfortably in God's grace. Someone they love but can't find the grace to stay sober in. In this group tonight, there are clergy people. People who are trained and love God, we assume, and who drink and cry out in frustration. There are people who have always rejected God and who drink and cry out in frustration. We get to the same place. It doesn't matter of skid row. It's a matter of a terminal grayness in your spirit. A terminal grayness. And now the color is destroying me. And there isn't even any color anymore. I'm sure most of you have had this experience sometimes. You've been on the wagon, maybe, and you take a drink, and it feels so good. Then it starts to gray out, and you may drink for 4 days trying to recapture that 30 seconds that you had. Just the feeling when it was good. Now, so what I'm trying to say is, if you are like me, if you are new tonight, or not so new, or troubled by this paradox, mouthing pretty phrases will not keep you sober. Knowing about God will not keep you sober, nor is it ever intended to in this program. The actions of Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe and I bet my life on it every day, the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous will enable you to be into a position where you can feel the security that comes from God's grace. And you don't even have to call it God's grace. I'm not trying to preach God to anybody. I would hate to do that. I don't do it to the people I sponsor. Maybe sometimes when after they've taken their fourth step. You can call it serenity. You can call it peace of mind. You can call it feeling solid. Or someday you might say, isn't that amazing? I believe that once in a while I have God's grace on me, and I can accept it. And sometimes I can't. Because sometimes, with all of the help available to me, I become petty, and I become emotional, and I get tired sometimes, and I lash out at people I love, and I hurt people I don't want to hurt. And I'm so sorry that I do it, because the momentary fatigue and pressure makes me crazy, but I don't have to defend it anymore. I can say, God damn it, that's not the way to be, and try to do better. One of the things I'm trying to work on now, and I've been sober a long time, compared to some of you, not as long as Jim, Harvey, and some of the other old pukes who ruined AA. Brother, a week ago tomorrow, or a week ago, or last Monday, there was kind of a small little ceremony for Chuck Seed out at Laguna Beach at a mortuary, kind of a small private memorial service. And his sons talked, and a few well-known friends of Chuck's talked, and I was pleased to be able asked to wind up the eulogy. And they'd all said what how sad it was he was gone, how touched they were by his life. And he certainly was. There have probably been three giants in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know people all over the world. That's the two founders and Chuck C. There's nobody comes no close to those people in the world. We take him for granted because he lived here. But I tell you, anywhere you go, you can go to France, and they say, do you know Chuck C? And you can go to England, you know Chuck C? Go to Australia. Everywhere you go in the world, Chuck C has been a great symbol. But I was talking that eulogy, and I said, yes, I personally was not sorry to see him die. I had talked to him the day before he died. He just had a small stroke, but he's still able to talk on the phone. He wouldn't give that up. And he thought, I'm fine. I had tears in my eyes. God, he's too good a man to have to be like this. I hope God takes him quick. And the next day he died. And everybody was so shocked. I was glad, you know. Because what people miss, they don't miss that old, poor, broken, sick, frightened man. What they miss is Chuck C., the dynamic man that lived and transformed many of our lives. But that man's been gone for some time. This is an old husk, ready to go. And the other thing I said, you know, has popped my mind, is really true. So I've been working on it myself this week. I said, one thing used to irritate me about Chuck. Very few things did. But one of the things that ever irritated me about Chuck, he never showed any selectivity whatsoever in who he talked to. He would talk to the goddamnedest old pukes that ever lived. I'm on Skid Row, and I wouldn't be caught dead talking to those fools, you know. And they live in Beverly Hills. Now, just, I'd say to them, Chuck, you know, that guy's a phony. He's been hustling people and hustling broads and hustling men for dough, and he's a phony son of a bitch. I think he's on pills. How can you sit and talk to him for an hour? Well, one of God's kids. I guess he wants to talk to him. No, no, that isn't right. I'll tell you who God's kids are, goddammit. I didn't say it, but I gave him a rail. I'll tell you. Well, that's very good, mister. Butter wouldn't melt in your mouth. He always used to kid me. You know, Clancy, what thing that Mark tells me? He says, you can get to people that I can't touch with a 10-foot pole. You just get all these people you sponsor, Christ. You know, they just should, none of them should be sober. They're all just such weirdos. I said, well, now you're getting the idea. No, Chuck, but he would talk to people that I wouldn't talk to for 2 minutes. And I was thinking of that memorial. I suggest to those people, I suggest to you, suggest it to me. If you want to conduct yourself as a small transitory memorial to Chuck C. and everything he stood for, don't mouth pretty words. The next time you get a chance, talk a couple minutes to someone who you ordinarily would brush by, that you wouldn't talk to, that isn't up to your standards, that's a phony, that's an idiot. Stop and go over and say hi and talk to him. I've tried that several times this week, and the first time it just about made my skin crawl. I've done that several times, and it really isn't so bad. The reason I never did it, I thought it indicated approval from you. It doesn't indicate approval. It just means he's God's kid. Because the whole story of this fellowship and what we do in the action here, as I say, is to reach something. You can't reach it all the time because we're all human beings, and we're all, no matter how wonderful we are, sometimes we're just crappy other times. Petty and nasty and ugh. But we can increase the ratio of betterness, I suppose, and the percentage. And what we want to reach, we want to take these actions, and it sounds, hardly anybody in this room has ever heard me say this till tonight. I want to keep taking these actions so from time to time, I am worthy of God's grace. So I can truthfully say, as I can say tonight, through the grace of God, I have not had a drink since October of 1958. But I must keep taking the actions, because tomorrow I might forget that. I might become unworthy of God's grace again. If I'm counting on God to pull me through, I forget that I have to do things that bring that ability for me to accept. That's why life is an ongoing situation. That's why we gather here tonight, in a sense. I'm here to tell you, if you're kind of new or if you're not so new, don't make such a big deal next Tuesday about Christmas. Christmas is a nice thing. It's a socially acceptable emotional explosion. But you and I can't... True story. You and I can't afford emotional explosions. Emotional explosions, any high is followed by a low, I'll guarantee you. You beat your depressions when you're on your way up to your manic high. You don't beat them on the way down because the check is already written and coming on the tray.
Here it is, Jim. No, I didn't want that part. Nobody gives a shit.
And so as we close this meeting every year, I'll close it tonight by saying, from me to you and from all of us together, Christmas is going to be nice. Tomorrow might... Some of my children are coming in, my grandchildren, and I'll be just wonderful. And I decorated that goddamn tree tonight and only tipped it over once, putting those lights on. Had the worst crew ever putting on my house lights, just incompetence. Oops. One or two of them were good. Next year I'm going to do it myself. I'm going to warn them just one more time. But that's nice. That's what I give to them. We have a nice house that looks like a Christmas tree, and a Christmas tree looks like a Christmas tree, and there's food, and people are coming in. And I'm so glad you don't have the privilege I have. I don't have to go through Christmas. I'm going to go down and serve 3,200 meals on Skid Row to people who are dying. Not that that's good. It just keeps me busy. I'm not wondering, why didn't I get it this year again? Let them wonder why they didn't get it. Ha, ha, ha. But what I always say here, and it all sounds in Congress, but it really isn't. All of this has just been an introduction to what I want to say now. I'm not going to wish you Merry Christmas. That's baloney. I'm going to wish you Merry January 29th and a very happy June 3rd and a prosperous August, because these are all days equally important in our lives. We have to live in each one. We must take the actions to bring as much color as we can, to live in some degree of peace, to admit we're wrong, to say we're sorry, to get up and wipe your jaw and say, fate really landed one on me that time. But I'm not going to lay on the floor and whimper. I'm going to get up and say, try it again, Jim. So we can, through the paradox of AA, take the actions as a defense against that God crap and find that it brings you the grace of God that enables you to live in the world with some degree of peace and dignity that you never would have found otherwise. I'm glad to be here tonight. I'm glad this is my 25th year here, but I'm more glad that it's just tonight. We're all in the room. We're safe and sane and sober. I hope we're this way on each of the days that come before us. Not 3 days from now, but next November, year from September, month from July, together. Thank you.